This is a recording of the Sharon Parrott teleconference with the Center on Budget and Policy PR, scheduled for 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, June 1st, 2006. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your patience in holding. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Evelyn Gansglass. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Hello, and welcome to the third audio conference in the 2006 conference call series called Improving Employment Outcomes for TANF Recipients, Win-Win Solutions for Families and States. That is being hosted by the Center for Law and Social Policy and the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. My name is Evelyn Gansglass, and I'm Director of Workforce Development at CLASP. I'm joined by Sharon Parrott from the Center for on Budget and Policy Priorities, our invited speakers, whom I will introduce in a few minutes. The audio conferences focus on strategies to help TANF recipients succeed in the labor market, while simultaneously helping states meet higher participation rates mandated by the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. The focus of today's call is on helping TANF recipients access good jobs. In addition to the conference calls, CLASP and the Center have prepared a guidebook on new TANF changes and different policy options for states in the next phase of welfare reform. The guidebook is called Implementing the TANF Changes in the Deficit Reduction Act, Win-Win Solutions for Families and States. Among other things, the guide covers strategies for improving welfare-to-work programs and increasing engagement, options for providing income supplements and making TANF work for individuals with disabilities. The guide is available for download on both the Center and CLASP websites, and soon we will have hard copies for distribution as well. As a matter of introduction, let me focus very briefly on why it's important to help TANF recipients access good jobs. First of all, there are lots of bad jobs around, and projections are that 7 out of 10 occupations that are expected to generate the most jobs in the next 5 years will pay poverty level or just above poverty level wages. Various TANF leaver studies have shown that many of those leaving welfare for work are in fact able to find work, but their employment is in low-wage, unstable jobs that cannot sustain a family. But close to 3/4 of those leaving TANF worked at some time in the year after TANF. Only about 1/3 worked all 4/4 of that first year. A study of Wisconsin's program found that in the 6th year after leaving the TANF program, only 16% of those TANF leavers had earnings above the federal poverty level, and 60% had earnings below 25% of the poverty level. Research by Harry Holzer, Julia Lane, Frederick Anderson at the Urban Institute on the labor market experience of low-wage workers between 1996 and 2001 found that low-wage workers' ability to rise above low earnings is strongly associated with the kinds of jobs people get and the kind of firms in which they work. So helping people gain access to jobs in medium and high-wage firms is important. Large firms tend to pay more than small firms, and they usually provide better benefits. More large firms provide paid leave and opportunities for on-the-job learning. Higher-wage firms have significantly less turnover. Less turnover translates into job retention for employers and opportunities for advancement. Although the research is clear that necessarily staying in that first job is not necessarily the best way for advancement, but staying in a firm does provide some opportunities for advancement. Industry and occupation in which people work is also important to moving out of poverty. Industries such as construction, manufacturing, transportation, utilities, and wholesale trade tend to pay better than other industries and occupations that provide employment opportunities for less educated workers. However, Holzer and other researchers point out that job quality can vary widely both within industries and within occupations. So it's important to target quality jobs and quality employers both within industries and across occupations. Our speakers today are going to talk about different ways in which states can build on can focus on job quality in their TANF programs. Our first speaker is Jerry Rubin. Jerry is Vice President of Jobs for the Future and Director of the Building Economic Opportunity Project. He's going to start us off with a discussion of what we've learned about the kinds of employer characteristics that contribute to worker advancement and success in the low-wage labor market. And he's also going to talk about the kinds of data that can be used to help identify both good jobs and good employers in the region. Our second speaker is Brian Stone. Brian is Executive Director of the Center for Workforce Leadership and Vice President of Policy and Programs at WorkSource in Jacksonville, Florida. WorkSource provides services to job seekers, including TANF recipients, and employers in Northeast Florida. Brian is going to talk about policies and strategies they have put together to target good employers and thereby expand to target good employers for employer services and thereby expand customer access to good jobs in the region. Our last speaker is Dan Miller. Dan is director of the Los Angeles County GAIN program based in the County Office of Education. He will discuss LA County's approach to job search and how the focus on living wage jobs has improved employment outcomes for recipients. Each speaker will speak about 10 minutes, and then we will have an opportunity for a number of questions and answers, and after all of the speakers have a chance to speak, we'll open up all the lines for a broader discussion about the issues raised. So with that, let me turn it over to Jerry Rubin.
Thanks, Evelyn. I'm going to talk briefly this afternoon about two pieces of research that my colleagues and I at Jobs for the Future have been involved with over the last year or so. One is a piece of research that we did as part of the Annie Casey Jobs Initiative, which focused on how the Jobs Initiative engaged employers to benefit low-income job seekers and employees. And then secondly, I'm going to touch briefly on some recent research we did called The Right Jobs, which looks at a set of occupations that seem to hold significant promise for lower-skilled individuals to advance to good wages. So let me start with the focus on the Jobs Initiative and just a little bit of background for those listeners who may not be familiar with the Jobs Initiative. The Annie Casey Foundation began the Jobs Initiative in 1996. It came to a conclusion just about a year ago. It was a multi-site workforce development initiative that received investments of more than $30 million of private and public dollars. The Jobs Initiative worked with intermediary organizations in Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Seattle, St. Louis, New Orleans, and Denver. And just to give the listeners a sense of the population that the Jobs Initiative worked with, approximately 5,500 Jobs Initiative enrollees were placed in jobs during the life of the Jobs Initiative. And some characteristics of those 5,500 placements, 35% had less than a high school diploma upon placement, 20% spoke other than English as a primary language, 45% were receiving public assistance, 59% had incomes of less than $9,000, and 11% had no previous work experience. About a year and a half, 2 years ago, we began doing some research here, really trying to understand the employer's perspective on the work of the Jobs Initiative, both how the Jobs Initiative served employers and what kinds of employers were engaged in the Jobs Initiative and why, and what difference that had for the individuals who were placed in Jobs Initiative jobs. So in order to give a feel of that, we did a survey of 55 employers that worked with the Jobs Initiative that had hired 10 or more Jobs Initiative referrals. So these are really major employers in the Jobs Initiative. They received an in-depth survey, and then we did in-depth interviews with just about a dozen particular employers that had hired a substantial number of Jobs Initiative referrals to get a deeper understanding of the nature of those employers and their experience with the Jobs Initiative. Let me first talk briefly about how the Jobs Initiative targeted good employers and good jobs. When the Casey Foundation started the Jobs Initiative, it focused really on several what they called assumptions or givens. One, a very important one, well, I guess has now come to be called a dual customer, was that the Jobs Initiative intermediaries, or the sites that I mentioned earlier, should be treating employers as equal customers with job seekers, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Secondly, the foundation restricted intermediaries to placements at a minimum of $7 an hour and health benefits. So at the time that this started, minimum wage was $4.85. I should say that the average placement wage actually was just over $9 an hour, $9.13 an hour. And the focus on placement wage was strictly enforced by the foundation in terms of how intermediaries actually were reimbursed for their expenses. And then thirdly, the foundation emphasized that its intermediaries should take a very focused sectoral approach that targeted promising industries and which emphasized deep knowledge of those industries and strong relationships with employers. There were a couple of characteristics that we found about employers that were involved in the Jobs Initiative that the evidence suggested contributed substantially to low wage worker success and advancement. From the point of view of the intermediaries, the most important role that the intermediaries, the sites that I mentioned earlier, played for the job seekers was that they screened employers to find those that offered better than average wages and benefits. As I mentioned, this was driven by the foundation's strict performance requirements on placement wages, benefits, and retention. The benefits that Case Jobs Initiative employers provided often included internal training and advancement policies, supervisory training, mentoring, more flexible disciplinary procedures, as well as health insurance, which was required. A substantial number of the employers that were targeted by the Jobs Initiative intermediaries implemented new practices to support their entry-level workers, often with the direct help of the Jobs Initiative intermediary. Some of these practices included the structuring of internal career ladders, development of mentoring programs, structuring of English as a second language on-site training, supervisory training, and performance rewards. One important feature that ended up being a major screen by the Jobs Initiative was that to the employer, and you found this both through the survey work and the interviewing that we did, employers, Jobs Initiative employers, had a very, very strong combination of deep civic values, that is, a commitment to the community and to the general welfare of the residents of that community, as well as a strong belief that working with the Jobs Initiative intermediary, they could improve their bottom line. So this was really kind of a double bottom line characteristic that we found across the board with Jobs Initiative employers, both a strong focus on civic values as well as a belief that working with the Jobs Initiative would strengthen their bottom line. On the flip side, the Jobs Initiative intermediaries provided their employers with a number of important services that kept them participating. For the employers, the intermediaries reduce the perceived risk of hiring jobs initiative clients through screening and training. This was probably the most often mentioned value as far as the employers were going, which was reducing the perceived risk. The intermediaries provided soft skills training, which the research shows was most strongly correlated to short-term retention, that is 3 and 6 month retention. The intermediaries developed custom programs with their employers for their entry-level employees, and the intermediaries developed technical skills training, which is most strongly correlated with long-term retention, that is 12 months and longer. Before I touch briefly on the right jobs, I just want to mention a couple of suggestions for organizations and programs that are working with employers that came out of this jobs initiative research. And I think some of these are self-evident. Others are you have to dig a little bit deeper, and maybe we can talk about those in the conversation. The research showed us that becoming reliable workforce partners is key for deep employer relationships. That is, to become a vendor of key entry-level employer services that are flexible, adaptable, creative, and responsive to specific business requirements. Secondly, it's a sophisticated sectoral approach that can build deep knowledge and relationships with employers is critically important. The Milwaukee Jobs Initiative and Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership is one of the better examples of this kind of very strong sectoral approach, the Seattle Jobs Initiative as well. Thirdly, combine incumbent advancement services with placement services that meet employer needs and meet the needs that employers see that relate to their actual everyday workplace activities. And then fourthly and finally, the intermediaries did and should provide information, ideas, and resources to help the employers that they work with develop new HR approaches. I know I'm going to be running out of time, so I want to switch gears very quickly and talk a little bit about the right jobs. The right jobs is a piece of research that we undertook about a year ago that was trying to determine whether there were a set of factors that would identify key occupations that would be occupations providing better than average advancement opportunities for low-skilled workers. I think in some ways our motivation was trying to determine whether or not beyond some of the healthcare occupations which so much attention has been paid to, were there other occupations where there was interesting and important promise for workforce providers and actually for individuals to pursue. So we undertook an analysis of U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data on 725 occupations, and we set out several criteria that we used as screening to get down to 16 promising occupations that we looked at in more detail. We screened for earnings, that is, we screened out occupations that paid more than $25,000 per year. We screened for availability. We were looking for occupations which had more than 20,000 openings per year. We screened for accessibility, that is, jobs that required an associate's degree or less and minimal previous work experience, with the idea that these should be accessible to lower-skilled individuals within a reasonable amount of time, given the requirements of a life of a working adult. And then finally, we added three additional qualitative screens. We looked at offshoring risk, technological innovation risk, and industry decline risk. As I mentioned, we identified 16 promising occupations. These included licensed practical nurse, customer sales rep, truck drivers, maintenance and repair workers, bookkeeping, accounting, and auditing, secretaries, carpenters, plumbers and pipe fitters, electricians, auto service technicians, police and security officials. The details of these occupations are spelled out in the research report, The Right Jobs. But what was interesting was once we identified these occupations, we then went deeper and probed into these occupations to really understand in a fine-grained way what does it take for a low-skilled individual to get into and then move up in these occupations. So we talked to employers, to their trade associations, to trainers who specialize in these areas, to try and give a more fine-grained understanding of what does it take to succeed in these right jobs. I'll stop there.
Great. Thanks a lot, Terry. That was just great. I think we have time for some questions. Operator, are there any questions in the queue?
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. And if at any point you need to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now.
While people are doing that, let me ask the first question. Jerry, what did it take for the Jobs Initiative project to really implement this dual customer focus? Was there training of staff required? What were the leadership dimensions of that? How did it happen?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting question because the Jobs Initiative, as I mentioned, was in 6 different locations. And in those 6 different locations, the range of experience with employer engagement really varied from place to place. So, for example, I mentioned earlier the Milwaukee Jobs Initiative. There you had the base of very strong experience with a labor management partnership of Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership that was actually a membership organization. And so the organization from its onset was structured as a dual customer program because it actually had both labor and management, and they were members of the organization. In other cases, I'll give Seattle, the Seattle Jobs Initiative, as an example. And there were two. There was some restructuring that had to take place. For one thing, the Seattle Jobs Initiative established key lead staff people that were the primary liaisons on a sector by sector basis to employers, and in a sense, they became salespeople to the employers in those sectors. The other thing that the Seattle Jobs Initiative did was it partnered with a number of community-based organizations and ended up developing a very strict set of quality criteria around case management in order to ensure that there was really high quality of case management, as it would certainly affect the relationship both with the employee and with the employer. So in some cases, there was substantial culture change that had to take place. In some cases, restructuring and putting in new systems. And in other cases, the capacity was there and just was refined and developed over time.
Great. Are there any questions?
At this point, we have 2 questions in the queue. Our first question comes from Enid Watson with Help in Recovery. Please go ahead.
Hi. I have your wonderful Jobs for the Right Jobs article right in front of me. Thank you so much. I see that these right jobs do require some significant training or education, and I'm a little confused about how you factored that into the promising occupation, since we have a limited window of time for most TANF recipients to receive that education.
Yeah, it's a very good question. This paper was not specifically oriented to TANF recipients, and it wasn't based on the assumption. I mean, it's really a demand side paper, not a supply side paper, in that it starts with the assumption that these are the occupations that pay what we believe is kind of minimal family sustaining wage, but are realistically achievable by a working person with some significant motivation and a not insignificant level of skill. These are not for individuals, for example, who are at a third or fourth grade literacy level. I do think you raise a really interesting point, which is from a public policy point of view. Very few of these occupations don't require some level of training or even post-secondary education. And, you know, obviously one good example would be in the healthcare field with the LPN position. Some of them that's not the case, the construction positions. Really there's, you're talking about pre-apprenticeship programs that get one into an apprenticeship queue. So there is a range of what you might call higher educational skills and non-higher educational skills. But it does raise the issue about the time required to move into positions that pay family-sustaining wages. It's not as simple as a placement. This is a, even for these positions, this is not an easy trip for most people to make.
Thank you.
One more question. Go ahead with the.
We have another question in the queue. This comes from Donalda Carlson with the Rhode Island Department of Human Services. Please go ahead. Ms. Carlson?
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
I feel like that commercial. my question relates to any perspectives you have with regard to individuals who just have a GED and what their potential for success, if you've been able to even look at it at this degree, what their potential for success translates into. We've got questions within our own state around the adult literacy issue, and we're being asked to think about this. I just wondered whether or not you had perspectives of your own through your experience.
Yeah, I have to say that while there are a couple of the occupations that we looked at would line up with a recipient of a GED, and we get into a little bit of detail on that in the report, I would have to say that our work in this area has led us in a somewhat a different direction than just looking at what the job opportunity is for a GED recipient. And that is to say that we are involved in work nationally with a group of community colleges and partner adult basic ed providers to substantially strengthen the transition between adult basic ed provision and entry into the community college. This is an enormous challenge because not only do most of the occupations that we've outlined, or many of the occupations we've outlined, required an associate's degree, but that's really kind of the minimum standard. I mean, you know, in a sense, for a as we know, more and more for a good-paying job and career, the associate's degree is the minimum level of education. It's really the bachelor's degree that is going to provide that that opportunity. But that leap from a GED to college readiness and then a associate's degree is enormous. So we've actually been focusing our attention on this very issue. I know there is some work in New England. The Nellie May Foundation is actually supporting some community college transitions work for adult basic ed providers, and I think that's the right direction to take.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we are going to leave, if there are any other questions, till later and move on to Brian Stone with Workforce in Florida, which, to my understanding, is one of those programs that really has a very strong dual customer focus. So, Brian, talk to us a little bit about what your approach is in Florida.
Well, thanks. I just wanted to give a little historical perspective on where we've come from and where we are today. As you may or may not know, Florida is a little different than the rest of the country, or a large portion of the rest of the country, in the way that the local workforce board is responsible for services under the Workforce Investment Act, services under Wagner-Peiser and Veterans Services, Job Corps, food stamps, and, of course, TANF. So we have a real synergy here. When the state challenged us to provide the TANF reemployment services, there were about 13,000 families receiving TANF in our six-county area. I pulled the numbers this morning because I thought it would be very interesting to mention that. As of today, there were a total of 771 families remaining on TANF in our six-county area. So you can see that there's been a huge reduction. And the evolution of the way we work with that population has certainly changed over that period of time. One of the things that we realized as the numbers of TANF recipients were falling was that while this was a really wonderful thing that people were going to work, we also realized that they were fast with becoming a working poor population. And we wanted to address that because we knew that if there were a downturn in the economy, these people would potentially be the first people back on the TANF rolls. So we created a program called GOALS. And what GOALS was designed to do was to provide education and training. And what we were going to do was, first of all, we paid people a stipend. It was a gift certificate to a local grocery store here. If they would just come in and listen to the presentation of what we would offer, then what we were prepared to offer them was paying for their education and training, paying for the child care and the transportation while they were attending training. And we sent out over 1,000 letters. And out of that, about half responded. And of that, only 5 people signed up for the program. So with that really bad experience, we went back to the drawing board and we said, you know, what is the problem? What aren't we offering? What aren't we doing right? And through a series of focus groups and talking to the TANF, former TANF recipients, what we found out real quick was these were people who had enough going in their lives already without considering going to education and training outside of the workday. They were handling full-time jobs, they were handling families, they were handling other responsibilities, and they just have more time in their schedule. So that led us to decide that we were going to try to do something different. So what we moved to was an employed worker strategy. And that caused us to rethink our business services in many different ways. On the First Coast, we're responsible to provide business services to 16,500 employers. And you can imagine with the size staff, we have about 200 people on staff. We just don't have the manpower to treat every business the same. So what we did was we came up with a strategy where we would provide different levels of service to different businesses. And we never say no, it's just how much yes do we say. So we have 3 different levels of business accounts. The basic level is a business account, and they receive free job listings, they receive labor market information, and just some basic services. The next level is key accounts, and they get a little more service. They have someone who works with them, with their HR department. And the third level is a premier account. They get everything. And how we segment those is by assigning a point system to what they are offering. They get more points if they are growing in our targeted occupations, if they are offering jobs within the company that have career paths with income and skill advancement, if their business offers tuition reimbursement, structured skill advancement training or outside training subsidies. They get points assigned for the number of job openings they have, if they provide benefits, if they provide flexible scheduling, they have family-friendly practices. So we have a criteria that they get assigned points by, and depending on where they fall in our grid, they either get assigned as a business, a key, or a premier account. Now, that had to happen in order for us to really put and implement our employed worker training strategy. This year, we're going to hit over 3,000 people trained. And what happens there is we have designed an income growth strategy where the people who are coming into our system are counseled and given strategies on career advancement, career growth. After they're placed in jobs, we approach employers, or employers approach us, actually, to apply for training funds. It's part of that continuum of services that we provide to our business community. And we never fund more than 49% of the training costs. The business always has to fund at least 51% of the training costs. And with that, they also sign an agreement that if there are any job vacancies, because people are moving up in their careers, we have first shot at backfilling those positions. So this past year, we have, as I said, we're targeting 3,000 trainings, and the gauntlet is everything from lean manufacturing principles to welding, nursing, just every occupation that makes sense for our local labor market, we are supporting and training to. What this really made us do was rethink who was our customer. And what we decided was our customer was business, because they were the ones who were going to be providing the real growth jobs that were going to be providing the kind of income that our former TANF recipients and all the populations that we serve really need in order to reach economic growth. The challenges in placing low-skilled workers and quality jobs is, I'm sure, the same challenges that the rest of the nation is facing. The one really bright point that we have here in our local labor market area is that we have a 2.8% unemployment rate, which means that there is a real high demand for workers. We can't actually get enough workers. And that really has lent itself to our strategy of employed worker training, because employers are willing to take people with basic skills who display or are willing to display good soft skills. They're willing to give them a chance, which really lets us integrate and apply that employed worker strategy. So, Evelyn?
Yes, great. Let's open this up for questions at this point.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Again, that star followed by 1 on your touch-tone phone if you have a question.
And while the queuing takes place, let me ask the first question. In this incumbent worker, employed worker strategy, is there a role for pre-employment training orientation as well?
Absolutely. You know, what we do when a person comes to us, when a customer comes to us, the first thing we do is we have a month-long class where we offer them training not only on soft skills, but also on what does the labor market look like. What and that is also accompanied by strong assessments, which shows them their strengths and their weaknesses and helps guide them into, hopefully, into good career choices so that they can take the skills that they have and utilize those to head towards a career goal.
Good. Are there any questions?
There are no questions in the queue at this point.
Okay. Why don't we move on and have Dan make his presentation, and then we'll open it up for a broader discussion. Dan?
Good. We're kind of in a unique situation in Los Angeles in that the County Office of Education worked with the Department of Public Social Services to write the first GAIN proposal in 1988, and we then bid for a piece of that, which was the motivation piece, a one-day motivation. And from 1988 to 1993, it was basically a program, it was a volunteer program, about 10% of the welfare participants were enrolled in it, and it was basically an ABE, ESL, GED type of program. MDRC came in and studied the results of 5 years of doing this, and it was basically that very few of those individuals were graduating from those programs, completing those programs, getting jobs, and it was a very costly program to run. So our boss, DPSS, decided to, in 1993, look for more of a work-first type of approach. And on that contract, we bid on the job club. So in 1993, we were also doing job club, which was a traditional three-week job club type program of, we didn't really talk about careers or advancement or anything like that. It was just kind of get a job. And the placement rate went from about 7% for the first 5 years of the program before we took it over to our placement rate was around 30%. At that time, historically, the minimum wage job rate in California was 4.25. And so anything more than 4.25 was a placement. And that kind of went on until the reauthorization. And in the 1996, we kind of just took the model that we had been working on and kind of modified it slightly. And we had quite a few people finding employment. And our placement rate stayed about the 35-40%. The hours that were required to work went from 20 hours to 32 hours, but the placement rate stayed about the same. And we really didn't track what people made, but just looking at the figures, you can see it wasn't much more than minimum wage. In 1999, the county had quite a bit of extra money and performance incentive money, and they put together a fantastic task force and developed something called a long-term family self-sufficiency plan. And it looked at all the things that a welfare participant would need in their life, and there were 46 different projects that came out of that. Well, one of them was changing the way we do job club. And that started in 2002. Now, 2002, the minimum wage had moved up to $6.75. So the goal in this program was, this was basically a four-week program, so it was 1 week longer than the traditional job club. But the first week, there was absolutely positively no looking for a job. It was 40 hours, and it was all about finding out the individual's strengths, their weaknesses. They put together something called a career plan. We used the Department of Labor's interest profiler for the interest aspect of that and also for their values clarification. A lot of time on the computer doing labor market information to see what type of careers were out there, what type of growth was out there, what, looking at their employment history, things that they had done, what they liked, what they didn't like. And then they came up with something called a career path. Now, after that first week, they left with what we called a targeted job search. And then the targeted job search, it's kind of like a bullseye. The target there is they were looking for a job that paid living wage. And for us in Southern California, that was $8.32 an hour with benefits or $9.47 an hour without benefits. And that's the job they were looking for the first week. The second week, they could move outside of the bullseye to the next ring and look for promotable jobs, jobs that they had the skills for that would lead to into living wage jobs. And at the end, the last part of their search the next week was looking for skill-building jobs. They had very little work history, and hopefully combining that with education and training. So that's kind of the method that we used, and where we ended up at is it took almost 4.5 years to get to the point where staff truly valued a higher level paying job. And I was looking at the statistics from 2005, July to currently, and a third of our jobs have been in the below living wage rate, averaging $7.53 an hour, and 18-19% of our jobs are averaged $11.36 an hour without benefits, and 15% averaged $10.26 an hour with benefits. So those statistics are a tremendous growth for us, and the placement statistics for last month was at 35%. So our placement has gone back up to where it used to be. The jobs are paying more, and I think the key part of this is that participants really are looking for jobs that pay more, have living benefits, and kind of match their needs and their interest instead of just meeting the requirement of getting a job. And I just kind of like to piggyback on to what Brian talked about briefly was when we thought that if people just got a job, that would be good in the old days, and then they would go to school in the evening. And we had all kinds of performance incentive money for post-employment services. We tried giveaways. We tried everything. If we could get them to show up for the workshop, no one signed up for the post-employment type of activities. It was just too much. It was just too much, too many things going on. And MDRD studies showed, that individuals just didn't advance on their jobs. They just, the amount of money that they made after like 2 or 3 years just didn't go up. And so it was critical to get them into the highest job that we possibly could. And that's kind of the direction we took. Now, the other piece that was critical to this was that came out of the long-term self-sufficiency plan work group was that when they started that search for a skill-building job at the end of their time, we brought assessment in right then. So rather than having an assessment 4, 5, 6 weeks later, they were part of the classroom. And there was a team meeting with the caseworker from the Department of Public Social Services, our instructor in the job club, and the assessor. And they met. They looked over the career plan that the person developed. They talked about their strengths, their weaknesses. Then they did a pretty comprehensive 2-day assessment for the person and help them put together a plan as to what it's going to take to get a living wage job. And most, I think, of the individuals are probably appreciative of that and kind of understood that, you know, we tried getting a living wage job and we just couldn't do it with the skills that we have. We do need some more education. We do need some training. And so we haven't seen the results of what's happening with those individuals who are going on to education and training and what the results are, but I feel pretty comfortable with that. So that's kind of what we're doing in Los Angeles County.
Sounds very interesting. Everybody has some form of job search activity, so this is something that really could be done in just about any TANF program throughout the country. I think we're ready for questions. Operator, can you... do them?
Ms. Gianquas, did you want to do questions or did you want to open all the lines?
I guess you're right. Let's open all of the lines at this point so we can ask questions directly of Dan and and broaden the questions as well. Let me, while that's happening, let me ask a question of Dan. You focused on the job search activities. Do you also have job developers who work with employers to try to generate some or identify job openings and cultivate some employers?
Well, we do, but we have a limited number. Most of the job development activities come out of the Department of Public Social Services, and so they have job developers, and their job developers come into our classroom and work with our participants in that way.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Evelyn, this is Sharon. Can I
sure,
ask a question?
Sharon, go ahead.
Can you talk about... when people go through this job club, but now there's this focus on higher-paying jobs, can you talk about what the kinds of jobs are that they're getting, the difference? Give us some examples of, because since these are presumably the typical TANF recipients in Los Angeles, to speak a little bit more concretely about what jobs that many of these people are typically getting.
What we've seen is they're not that much different than the type of jobs they got before. They're just higher paid, higher level jobs. They're really looking for a higher level job. We have connections with the health industry, and we get them into those type of jobs. We have some connections with some of the unions, and we get them into some of the port type jobs that we have because of the transportation hub in Southern California. It's just kind of a, there isn't like one specific type of job that they kind of go into. We assumed that there'd be a lot of jobs in the hospitality field in Southern California, but that for us, that has never really worked out. We thought that would be probably our largest promotable job, because there's so many people that can start at a lower level in the hospitality and work their way all the way up to the top. But we have some in that, but nothing like what I thought it would be. And the end result is really do a lot of directing for their job search of themselves. They do a lot of the information on the internet. We bring the job leads in. The job developers bring job leads in. But they're really doing a lot of the search themselves. They use a lot of technology. They send out their resumes, et cetera. So it's more of a self-directed type thing.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
I have a question. This is Rhode Island again.
Please identify yourself before asking.
Donalda Carlson in Rhode Island. I'm wondering if you have, since you are kind of consistent with your 35% placement rate, my question is, do you have experience working again with those who didn't get placed?
Oh, yes. I think we've all had that. I think we've seen people who've come through 4, 5, 6 times.
Okay.
And, you know, we are consistent at 35% now, but in 2002, we were just going, we were having a hard time hitting 20% placement, getting back to, you know, which was the contract requirement. And we were having a heck of a time, but the economy's picked up, staff feels better. We went to go from a 7% placement to a 20% placement, you have to really put an emphasis on getting a job. And so there was a lot of motivation about getting a job, cheering, and all those type of things that were on, which are good things. But now to change that to say, well, that's a job, but it's not really like a really good job, that took several years to change the philosophy of our staff and probably DPSS to kind of let them know that, you know, let's hold off a week. Let's not jump at this job. Let's try to have 2 or 3 offers. Let's try to get the best job. Let's try to, and so that's been a challenge. But when people come through this the second or third time, the one nice thing is that first week is so self-directed in that they're kind of, it's their interest, it's their abilities. They're putting their plan together. And then after that, if they come in with their resume already done and everything finished, they don't have to sit through those type of classes. They just use the tools that we have available so they can go out and find employment.
Okay. Dan, this is Evelyn again. Can you talk about the kinds of culture change training that you had to that you went through?
Well, it's I can remember the beginning. It started in 93 when we went from an education to a work first type of approach. So I had to go out and talk to the members of DPSS, the caseworkers, to try to let them know this is what we're trying to do. And you talk about a message that was not well received. They were convinced that no one could even get any kind of a job. So that went for 2 to 3 years of trying to work with them, quarterly meetings, and my staff. Then when we finally got into that point, in 3 years after that, then we started looking at a better type of job, because our logo is a job, a better job, a career. And so now we're looking at how do we get into that better job. Once again, it took a lot of training to change the mindset. We have 800 and some caseworkers from DPSS, and I have a staff of a couple hundred. To change that philosophy, that was not easy. We developed, put together a staff development unit of four of our very best folks that rewrote the curriculum, brought staff in, trained staff, went out, observed staff, trained the managers what to look for and how do we deliver this material, and then bring them in for quarterly in services to bring up their skills. But that piece took much, much longer than I ever thought it would. It took longer to do that than it did to encourage people to change to a work first, which we started to in the beginning. That was, to go from education to work first was very, very simple compared to going from work first any job to work first better job.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes, tell us who you are, Matt.
Okay. My name's Enid Watson again. I wondered if anyone is doing anything with employer tax credits anymore or the federal bonding opportunity.
Hey, fellas, it's your time.
I don't know who to direct the question to.
Well, this is Brian in Jacksonville. We really aren't. I mean, we might provide that after the person is placed as just a continuum of services, but that isn't how we would sell a person. We sell a person based on their skills and abilities or the potential that the employer is looking for. And, you know, the one thing I don't think I emphasize strong enough is that because we've built such a strong relationship with our business community, a lot of times the people whom we're sending out might not have all the skills and abilities the business is looking for, but they're willing to take a chance. They're willing to open the door. Plus, we have a lot of opportunities because of upward mobility of people being trained in the company and moving up.
This is Jerry. We took a look at the employer tax credit issue as part of a project we worked on with the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, looking at employer engagement and workforce development, and I have to say that the response was it was not significant. That it seemed as though, if you were to list out the major concerns and motivations of employers for hiring what might be perceived as non-traditional employees, the tax credits was way, way down at the bottom of the list. And I know in the jobs initiative, as far as I know, in the jobs initiative, it was not utilized as a tool.
Just keep working.
Whoever's talking, please mute your phone.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not.
Excuse us. Somebody, we're hearing somebody talking. Go ahead, Jerry. Continue.
Just to say that in the jobs initiative, as far as I know, tax credits were not used as a tool. Now, I know there's been some work in the last couple of years by a couple of organizations, unsuccessful as to date, actually to try and develop some kind of business line out of employer tax credits and structure them in a syndication format. I've yet to see successful implementation. So, you know, I think that my own experience in this research suggested that the actual real labor dynamics are what you're going to be dealing with, and that more than a financial incentive, it's too complicated. It doesn't really fit the kind of the everyday dynamics of the workplace, and having reliable placed individuals who are well screened and highly motivated is way up on the list.
Thank you. And I don't think the federal bonding ever really took off either. But thank you.
Right, this is Evelyn. I just happened to have been in a one stop yesterday in Baltimore and asked about the federal bonding program. And apparently, you know, the amount of the federal bonding, I think the limit is $5,000 in the federal program, and it just doesn't do enough. So again, it's a risk factor, and that bonding, at least from the employer point of view, what we were told yesterday, it just isn't sufficient to overcome the risk. Either they're going to do it, and this was about people coming out of the criminal justice system, so it's not this population, but that it just wasn't enough to change the trade-offs for the employer. Are there other questions, comments?
I've got a question.
Yes.
This is John from South Carolina Department of Social Services. Question for our panelists. We've been stricken with a lot of plant closures here in South Carolina, with textile mills shutting down. You know, folks have been working at these facilities for many years, and we're looking to ask our panelists here what type of recommendations they'd give. You know, we're thinking about orchestrating job fairs on behalf of these folks, or any other avenues they might recommend.
Anybody dealt with job layoffs?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm asking Brian or...
Yeah, I'm asking all three panelists. Brian, Jerry, and Dan, they might have any insight into this.
It's certainly not something we're dealing with right now, but in the past, you know, we have. And again, that goes back to... really being integrated and working with your business community to find out where are the growth jobs, and then looking at that population who is being separated and finding out, you know, what are the transferable skills among those. I don't know if you've done anything like that. I don't know, you know, what your labor market is as far as what might be in the growth area and how the people coming out might have skills that could be cross-transferable, and where are the gaps to be trained to. And then certainly my strong suggestion would be to train to those gaps as some sort of part of a employed worker strategy.
Just this is Jerry. We've not specifically dealt with displaced workers, and the jobs initiative didn't, but there are several state community college systems that have mobilized around this very issue. In fact, your neighbor, North Carolina, may be one of the best examples nationally, where particularly dealing with the decline in the furniture industry, most recently in earlier textiles, but utilizing the full range of resources and services available through the community college system, both through assessment, skill transferability analysis, and then obviously education and training, I think it's a very powerful tool. Not easy, but important one. So that's the one comment I'd make.
You know, John, I'd just like to say that I feel your pain, because it's in California. You can open my door and throw a rock and hit the former North American / now Boeing now parking lot. And they took that beautiful piece of land, and now there's like a Home Depot and there's a Chili's and all those type of places. And probably as many people employed in that square footage now as before. They did the same thing just north of us in Van Nuys to a GM plant. They did the same thing down south to another Boeing plant in the Long Beach area. And those quality jobs, those union jobs or high-paying type jobs, are leaving us, and the service sector jobs just don't pay the same rate. And it's very frustrating, and it's very frustrating for us when we're working with participants that come in with those type of skills, because you know it's a challenge to go in and try to replace the type of salary that they were making before.
I think we have time for one or two more questions. Are there any other on the line? I do have a question, and I'd like to go back to something that that Brian talked about in relationship to the employer services and companies, firms willing to take more of a risk with people who may not have all of the work experience or skills. And I guess I'd like to ask both Brian and all three of you to talk a little bit more about the kinds of employer services and supports that could be provided on the employer side within the context of a TANF program and the limitations within that that you think could help increase, you know, placements, access to better jobs.
You know, once again, we for those employers that we identify as being premier accounts, and those are the employers that are really going to provide real living wages for our customers. We are willing to do almost anything. I mean, we will work with them hand in hand to develop retention strategies, do turnover studies for them. We will provide them with assessment supports. We will provide them with recruiting. We will provide them with after the sale services in the form of training monies, in the form of interventions, if need be, with the customers that we've placed there. But we also stay in touch with the people that are placed and work with them to help them integrate their lives and themselves into the new work situation. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that we will do for a business who really becomes one of our partners and who is providing that real quality job.
Are there lessons from the jobs initiative there as well, Jerry?
Well, you know, I think in the jobs initiative, the jobs initiative intermediaries that developed long-term deep relationship with the employers were, you know, it's really kind of it's a similar answer to the previous answer, which is that they kind of would develop almost like a customized response, and this really was a customer service orientation for the best customers, and then would design a range of services that met the employee and employer needs, you know, and I mentioned some of them, you know, earlier. Everything from mentoring system to incentive reward systems. Going beyond the jobs initiative, one thing I would want to say, other than, you know, because that's really like a one-by-one strategy, is that there are a number of pretty interesting employer engagement and advancement strategies that have been used that focus more specifically on sectoral interests. I mean, some of this is very unique to each individual employer, and there's no getting around that. But there are some common issues, and I just, as one, and this is relevant to state policy, here in my own state, Massachusetts, the Extended Care Career Ladder Initiative, which focused pretty substantial public and private resources on the long-term care industry, has been focusing on building partnerships with nursing home, individual and nursing home chains, to build common sets of retention and advancement services for certified nursing assistants and up into LPNs. And I think with great success and achieving pretty significant scale, I think at this point more than 20% of the nursing homes in the state have been participating, and you see a lot of commonality on the kinds of strategies because the issues they're facing are almost identical from nursing home to nursing home. So it's not, I think there are, a lot of this is about individual approaches and customer service. I think that's absolutely right, but there are some broader sectoral approaches that are very effective.
Thank you. One last question.
Hi, this is Allegra Bader. I'm here at CLASP. And Gary, you just touched on this in the end of your remarks, but it's something all of you in your remarks talked about, the importance of a cultural change for the frontline staff in how they approach placing people in jobs and really focusing on higher quality jobs. And my question for all of you is, what policy changes can support these kinds of cultural changes for the people on the lines who are interested in these state policy issues?
You know, I just mentioned one, which is that, you know, a number of states, you know, as I mentioned, Massachusetts, my own, but I think Pennsylvania is a really good example of a state, and there are others that have identified key segments of their industry in which they're putting resources that specifically focuses on advancement services, as well as the kind of intermediary or partnership services that are important to develop the kind of efforts that we've been talking about today. Because this stuff often doesn't happen on its own. It's not. It's complicated, and it requires some pretty sophisticated organizing. So I do think states can do this, and a number of states have done it. I do think an industry focus can be very helpful, particularly in key industries that have common human resource issues. It's pretty efficient and effective. Incumbent worker training dollars, a number of states use UI diversion, and I think those are critically important resources. I think those are usually dollars very well spent.
Okay. Thank you all. This was a very interesting call. If there are any follow-up questions among the people who are listening in, please feel free to contact us at CLASP, and we will forward the questions to them, to the speakers. I just want, before closing, I just want to remind you that we will be having the fourth and last call of this series on June 20th, again from 1 to 2:15, and that call will focus on skill upgrading, the role of community colleges in helping low-skilled workers advance in the labor market. So although we have different topics for each of the calls, they all seem to circle back around, and it's all very interrelated. Thank you again for joining us, and that's it for today.
Thank you.